Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading this morning, we're going to skip one chapter to rearrange the speakers. Thank you for your understanding. We would be doing chapter 23, but today we'll do chapter 24 instead. That's page 342. By way of review, yesterday you remember we read about Lord Krishna's daily activities, and when the Lord was seated in his palace, two requests came to him. Remember what they were? When Lord Krishna was seated in his palace in his Sudharma assembly hall in Dwarka, two requests came to him. Right, the kings were imprisoned by Jarasandha, 20,000 kings, and he was asked to help free these kings. And then the other? Yes, the Pandavas were performing the Rajasuya sacrifice, and they wanted him to attend. So he was torn, even though he had just come from 16,000 different palaces and converged into one Krishna. He was wondering how he could be in two places at once. So what did he do? No. Yesterday. What did he do? He asked Uddhava to make a decision. So that's where we left off yesterday. That's where we will resume tomorrow. Okay? So for today, we'll skip ahead. And just to put in context here, we are reading Krishna's later pastimes, the Dwarka Leela. And this is kind of a wrap-up of all of the relationships that have been established in the earlier chapters. So that theme kind of pervades the last several chapters. It's helpful also to know something about the Mahabharata. Some of you do, most of you do, some of you don't. But a lot of the incidents that are going to be coming up have connection to the Mahabharata war, the Kurukshetra war, either before or after. So especially today, the second chapter about Lord Balaram, how he goes on pilgrimage. And so it's not totally explained here, so let me just make sure everyone understands that Balaram did not want to take part in the Kurukshetra war. And he didn't want Krishna to either. So he had a hard time controlling his younger brother. And his younger brother made this deal that I will take part on one side and my entire army can be on the other side. And the commanders could choose either between me and my army. But if I'm on your side, I won't fight. I'll only take a non-combat role. This was sort of his concession to Balaram. So the Pandavas wanted Krishna, Arjuna wanted Krishna, and Duryodhana wanted his army, so they were both satisfied. See, all these are very subtle connotations about how Krishna deals with the living entities. He's able to please everybody and give everybody what they desire, and at the same time keep his vows and keep his promises. So he's very clever like this. So in terms of Lord Balaram, we read about Balaram the other day. Balaram had asked Krishna not to fight, but Krishna was going ahead in this way, and Balaram decided he just did not want to be involved, so he went out on pilgrimage. And our second chapter today, chapter 25, deals with his encounter with Romaharshan on this pilgrimage. So that will be chapter 25. Okay, any questions on this? Let's read then. We'll start chapter 24, Salva, the mystic airship. O king, that is the question to your answer as to why the jealous, angry Duryodhan could not be satisfied. Now hear about another wondrous deed the Lord performed as he appeared among us in his transcendental form. A friend of Shishupal's named Salva watched Lord Krishna free Queen Rukmini from wedding Shishupal unwillingly. In the ensuing battle with the Yadus, Salva lost. He pledged, I will destroy this Yadu clan at any cost. On making this misguided vow, the foolish Shalva swore to daily fill his hand with dust, eat that, and nothing more. He begged Lord Shiva to reward his masochistic fast, and fairly soon this Shalva got the boon for which he'd asked. Lord Shiva gave, reluctantly, an airship that could fly throughout the earth and heavens to destroy and terrify. The iron plane was like a town and could not be destroyed by any curse or weapon, demon, man, or god deployed. So Shalva sent his army to seize Dwarka below as he flew overhead with every weapon he could throw, while tree trunks, hailstones, snakes, and deadly thunderbolts rained down. A whirlwind fiercely threw up dust, eclipsing all around. The citizens of Dwarka were frightened and harassed. Pradyumna, Queen Rukmini's son, assured them, "This will pass." Assembling great heroic Yadu warriors and guards, he struck the mighty Shalva, who continued to bombard. The armies clashed, the weapons crashed, and witnesses were stunned. As if he was the darkness, and Pradyumna was the sun, the wicked Shalva quickly found Pradyumna's golden shafts had punctured him and all his men. He energized his craft. The plane transformed to many airplanes, flying everywhere. Then it was one, and then it simply vanished in the air. Although Pradyumna's prowess pleased both friend and foe alike, the airship's mystic powers made it difficult to strike. At one point, Shalva's airship seemed to nestle to the ground. Then it appeared in water, on a hill, or flying round. The airship whirled and blistered, like a fiery baton, and yet the Yadu army stood its ground and battled on. Pradyumna struck down. Wherever Shalva showed his airship, Yadu arrows rained. Their burning, poisoned shafts left Shalva's soldiers hurt or slain. Duman, the chief of Shalva's forces, snatched his club of steel, fought off his foes, and struck a blow that made Pradyumna reel. Pradyumna's driver thought the blow had smashed his master's chest. Concerned for his security, the driver thought it best to take Pradyumna from the field until he'd cleared his head. Pradyumna, soon recovering, was furious and said, "Except for me, no Yadu warrior ever left a fight. This eunuch driver spoiled my reputation with a blight. What will I say to Ram and Krishna to excuse myself? My brother's wives will mockingly say, 'Did you mend your health?'" Pradyumna's driver answered, "Master, all that I have done is proper for a driver who has seen his master stunned. A driver saves his master, and a master does the same. I fled the battle lines with this in mind. Why feel ashamed?" Pradyumna drank some water, set his armor, took his bow, and said, "Wherever this Duman has gone, I want to go." Duman had crushed Pradyumna's army while he was away. Pradyumna, smiling, found Duman and drew him from the fray. Pradyumna wrecked the chariot Duman so proudly rode, then struck him with a deadly shaft that made his head explode. The Yadu archers rallied and, with great proficiency, made Shalva's soldiers tremble from the airship to the sea. Krishna returns. The battle thus went back and forth for 27 days. Lord Krishna, still in Indraprastha, on extended stay, saw inauspicious omens caused by dangers still unknown. With blessings from his loved ones, Krishna quickly went back home. Lord Krishna thought, "While I am here with my beloved brother, our capital could be attacked by one fool or another." He soon found Dwarka besieged. Augmenting its defense, he warned his driver, "Shalva's magic baffles common sense." His driver shook his reins and took Lord Krishna to the place where Shalva stood, and Krishna could confront him face to face. The crest of Garuda adorned the flag Lord Krishna flew, an emblem known to Krishna's men, and his opponents too. As soon as Shalva saw the Lord, he hurled a fearsome spear across the field of battle at Lord Krishna's charioteer. As if it were a comet, Shalva's spear lit up the sky, but Krishna's arrow splintered it in forceful, swift reply. Lord Krishna then pierced Shalva with a host of deadly shafts and filled the sky with arrows raining on his darting craft. Lord Krishna, like the sun, emitted sharp, pervasive rays till Shalva's arrow struck his arm and knocked his bow away. On seeing this, devotees wept as Shalva roared and yelled, "You fool, if you don't run right now, I'll send you straight to hell. You took your cousin Shishupal's fiancée, Rukmini, and when he wasn't looking, you destroyed him ruthlessly." The Lord replied, "Because you're dull and boast the way you do, you fail to see that death itself stands straight in front of you. A true, authentic hero rarely has too much to say. He simply puts heroic deeds on obvious display." With this, Lord Krishna furiously swung his mighty club on Shalva's collarbone. The demon groaned and threw up blood. Then Shalva simply disappeared as, simultaneously, a man in tears approached and sobbed, "I've come from Devaki. O Krishna, Krishna, mighty armed one, you're extremely kind. You love your dearest parents, who are always on your mind. This Shalva somehow seized your father Vasudev today. He bound him like an animal and dragged him far away." On hearing that his father had been taken by this thief, the Lord, who deeply loved his father, showed concern and grief. In this world, Krishna often acts like any mortal man, so, speaking like an ordinary person, he began, "My brother Balaram protects the city very well. He's never lost to any foe from heaven, earth, or hell. How could a speck like Shalva kidnap father from his hands? Almighty fate, indeed, has made a farce of all our plans." As soon as Krishna finished, Shalva once again appeared, this time with Vasudev in tow. With wicked eyes, he sneered, "You love your father most of all, and here your father stands. I'll murder him before your eyes. Protect him if you can." He sliced the throat of Vasudev and flew off with his head directly to his mystic plane, which hovered overhead. Then, for a moment, Krishna, though aware of Shalva's scam, became absorbed in sorrow like an ordinary man. Recalling the magic that Shalva displayed, Lord Krishna knew well it was all a charade. With Vasudev's corpse and the messenger gone, Lord Krishna saw through it and quickly fought on. This version, at least, is recounted by some who think that Lord Krishna could really succumb to such lamentation. They somehow forget the times that they've thought, God cannot be upset. How can lamentation, affection, or fear, all born out of ignorance, ever appear in he whose perception, good judgment, and might has no limitation of length, width, or height? Brahma kidnapped Lord Krishna's friends long ago, while Krishna pretended that he didn't know. As part of his loving exchanges of bliss, he relishes spiritual pastimes like this. If spiritual knowledge, made better with sweet devotional service to his lotus feet, destroys such illusions as body is self, how could they appear in Lord Krishna himself? The death of Shalva. As Shalva hurled weapons, Krishna shot him with his bow and used his club to smash the mystic airplane with one blow. The plane crashed in the water. Shalva, jumping to the land, ran madly up to Krishna with a bludgeon in his hand. A single dart from Krishna cut off Shalva's arm and club, and then, just as a mountain holds the morning sun above, Lord Krishna raised his shining disc and cut off Shalva's head. As head and crown rolled to the ground, the demons cried in dread. While gods above played kettle drums to celebrate the scene, another demon, Dantavakra, dared to intervene. His partner, Shishupal, and Shalva both met their demise, yet he attacked Lord Krishna, fury shooting from his eyes. The evil Dantavakra dashed toward Krishna, club in hand. The earth itself shook sharply as the mighty devil ran. The Lord jumped from his chariot and, sparring expertly, drove Dantavakra backwards as the shore holds back the sea. The reckless demon said, What luck to see you here today. O foolish cousin, killer of my friends, you're mine to slay. Indeed, the two were relatives, just two lives before, this Dantavakra was a keeper of Vaikuntha's doors. A relative like you is nothing more than a disease. By killing you, my debt is paid. My friends will all be pleased. As one might poke an elephant with all that he had said. First, Dantavakra goaded Krishna. Then he struck his head. Though struck by Dantavakra's club, Lord Krishna stood his ground. His own club met the demon's chest and made a crunching sound. The blow split Dantavakra's heart. He fell and dropped his club, and sprawling, left his body with a final heave of blood. A subtle, wondrous spark of light ascended from the corpse, for Dantavakra's sentence as a fiend had run its course. The floating spirit merged with Krishna, seen by one and all, exactly as had happened at the death of Shishupal. Then Dantavakra's father, Viduratha, snatched his sword, and breathing very heavily, swung fiercely at the Lord. Lord Krishna deftly dodged him and invoked his razor disc, decapitating Vidurath with one flick of his wrist. Since Shalva, Dantavakra, and his brother all were such extremely gifted warriors whom no one else could touch, the residents of heaven praised Lord Krishna on and on as he returned to Dwaraka amid festoons and song. And thus Lord Krishna, master of all mystic potencies, turns dismal situations into splendid victories. And only one whose consciousness resembles that of beasts thinks someone else could better Krishna, or indeed compete. So a few comments on this chapter very quickly. First, anyone remember who was Dantavakra in his last life? Yes, Jaya or Vijaya, right. Jaya and Vijaya came in three births. First as whom? Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, and then? Yes. And finally, this Shishupal, right? Shishupal and Dantavakra. So when Shalva, who had all these mystic powers, showed up with the Vasudev, this is a very interesting passage because Krishna reacted as if he were an ordinary person. He became discouraged, which was exactly Shalva's plan. But, of course, we know that Krishna could not become discouraged. So Sukadeva Goswami comments in this section, he kind of takes a little detour from the narration and talks about how and why all this happened. Why did Krishna show these apparent symptoms of remorse and sorrow? So one reason was to satisfy the common man who thinks Krishna is ordinary. Another reason was to satisfy Shalva, because Shalva wanted him to be fooled. So Krishna let him feel, okay, I fooled Krishna. And in his comments on this, Sukadev Goswami gives very strong philosophical arguments that undermine the notion that Krishna was materially affected by these events. You know, the whole foundation of our philosophy is that God is the creator of the material energy but is not affected by it. So this is constantly a difficult thing to understand for the conditioned soul because we're so affected by it. So in Krishna's pastimes, we see the residents of Vrindavan and other intimate devotees are affected by his spiritual maya. They keep falling into the reality of seeing Krishna as God, and then they have to be kind of nudged out of it because Krishna doesn't want them in that space. So they vacillate back and forth, whereas the conditioned souls vacillate back and forth, thinking that God exists and then thinking that, no, this material energy is so powerful that even God is controlled by it. So that was sort of the psychology of Shalva that Sukadev is addressing here. And he gives the example then of how Krishna pretended that he was bewildered by Brahma, when in fact he was never fooled by a moment. You remember he went to get his calves, and he came back and all the boys were gone, and Krishna goes, oh, what happened? Where are they? And Brahma's watching all this. So, anyway, very nice arguments. Any discussion on this topic before we go on? Yes, this is the thing. There's such a ridiculous idea about the devil competing with God. You know, the Judeo-Christian, or the Christian idea is that this devil, this angel fell from heaven and now has become this big threat to God. And he and God are squaring off over your soul. You know, and you better get on God's side or the devil's going to win. Isn't that it, more or less? So this fear, this terror, this terrible threat of the devil exists. And God's really, you know, the underdog in this case. So it's also silly. Where does the devil come from if he doesn't come from God? There's some other source of creation. Prabhupada talks about Krishna's front side, Krishna's back side, you know. So the asuras represent Krishna's backside, his rear end in the creation. You know, all the evil and negative things come from that part of God's universal form. This is described in the second canto. So the devotees also have some fear of Maya, but not like it is competing with Krishna. Rather, it is facilitating our material desires. So we're afraid of our own material desires. We're not afraid of some competing force to God. Like Prabhupada said, a devotee once asked him, why is Maya so strong? And he said, Maya is not strong. Your purpose is weak. So, all right, anything else? Yes, bye-bye. Yes, the whole purpose of Jayan Vijay coming, Prabhupada says, so Krishna can get some exercise just to keep the body fit. So yes, he wants to get to it. Yes, Jerry. The difference is that Krishna is just pretending to be affected. You know? Yeah. Well, okay, then the difference is that Krishna can snap out of it. How about you? Can you? It's like Prabhupada said about the hippies. They renounced, became very detached, but they could not give up sex life. See? So this, the Mayavadis are often like that. They renounce, but then they come back. They go away from society to meditate and just, but then they always come back because they get lonely. So they do some philanthropic work, or somehow they want to be back in the marketplace and back in the flow. So they're artificially renounced. And that is the difference. They cannot maintain their position. Whereas Krishna never actually leaves his position. Even when he apparently does, he's just doing it for many other purposes. Okay, let's read chapter 25. This is a short chapter, and then Gopal will elucidate. Chapter 25, Balaram's Pilgrimage. The Proud Romaharshana. Lord Krishna vanquished every brute who put the earth in pain, except for some Lord Balaram was destined to contain. At this time, though, Lord Balaram was touring holy sites, for Yudhisthira and Duryodhan, his friends, were set to fight. Instead of taking sides when his two cousins were at odds, Lord Balaram held rites to honor ancestors and gods. He went to holy tirthas, rivers, temples, and, at last, Naimisharanya forest, where the sages had amassed. The sages recognized the Lord and stopped their sacrifice to stand and bow, a greeting that is proper and concise. However, Romaharshana, infected with conceit, ignored the Lord, remaining in his elevated seat. Lord Balaram was outraged. Romaharshana, you see, possessed, of all assembled, the most common pedigree. Not only was he scornful by remaining in his seat, his sitting place was higher than the sages, saints, and priests. Lord Balaram said, due to lower birth and swollen head, this fool dishonors others. Such a leader should be dead. He may read many scriptures, but his character is such that all he's learned is in his head. His heart remains untouched. My mission is relieving earth of sinful hypocrites, pretending to be pious while refusing to submit to Brahmins, gods, or any other person, great or small. A cheater such as this is the most sinful fool of all. Despite the fact that Balaram was finished taking lives, the time for Romaharshana's demise had now arrived. So Balaram just touched him with a single blade of grass, and Romaharshana fell down in terminal collapse. The sages cried, "Alas, alas, O Balaram, our lord, your killing of this person is exceedingly untoward. We honored Romaharshana by giving him this seat and promised him protection till our yajna was complete. Unknowingly you killed the Brahmin we chose to anoint. Though we fault you for nothing, lord, please hear our simple point. No scripture binds you. You are God himself, we understand. And yet, if you atoned for this, you'd help the common man." Lord Balaram replied, "Of course, I'll gladly make amends. Prescribe for me whatever rite the scripture recommends. Just say the word and you'll see Romaharshana revive, fulfilling your assurances that he would live and thrive." The sages spoke among themselves and answered as if one, "O Lord, your act should stay intact. Let nothing be undone." The Lord replied, "The Vedas teach that one takes birth again as one's own son. So let this Brahmin's son fill in for him." The son, Suta Goswami, was at once installed to sit and lead the sacrifice with all his father's benefits. But Balaram requested, "Sages, tell me your desire. It still appears atonement of some kind should be required." Balvala slain. The sages said, "A demon named Balvala is so cruel, he spoils our sacrifice by throwing urine, pus, and stool. Please kill that sinful demon. Then, throughout the coming year, remain on pilgrimage. Thus your renown shall persevere." Before too long, a wind arose, infused with noxious smells. Balvala showered pus and stool by use of mystic spells. He then appeared in person with a trident in his hand, intent on driving holy sacrifices from the land. Balvala looked exactly like a hill of carbon black. His molten copper beard and topknot glowed as he attacked. Lord Balaram observed this horrid fangs and furrowed brow and called at once his fearsome club and demon-crushing plow. His plow tip snagged Balvala as he flew across the sky. Lord Balaram then smashed his club between the demon's eyes. His forehead cracked in gushing blood. Balvala looked just like a crimson mountain crashing down, assailed by lightning strikes. An attempt at diplomacy. The sages blessed Lord Balaram and praised his strength and skill. They bathed him as the gods bathed Indra when Vritta was killed. They next presented garlands of unfading blooms and leaves, as well as first-rate silken clothing set with jewelry. The sages then gave Balaram permission to depart. His pilgrimage, begun without the aid of horse or cart, took him by foot to India's most sacred holy sites. At every stop, the Lord took bath and honored every rite. He traveled so extensively that months and months went past. Concluding his atonement, Balaram was told at last that nearly every soldier in the Kuru civil war had died in Kurukshetra and would burden earth no more. Since Duryodhana, who Balaram supported, had survived, the Lord went on to Kurukshetra, bent on saving lives. He found the sons of Pandu had, as well, survived the war. They offered him obeisances, but then said nothing more. At that time, Duryodhana and Bhima, fighting with their clubs, were settling the conflict with each other's flesh and blood. Though Balaram trained Duryodhana, he wanted neither dead. Attempting to break up this closing fight, he stood and said, "You two are nearly equals in your bludgeon fighting skill. Since one has strength and one technique, why get each other killed? I do not see how either of you stand to win this test, so why not put your clubs down now and stop at my request?" When Duryodhana and Bhima couldn't set aside their hate, Lord Balaram saw Krishna had some reason for their fate. Since neither was agreeable to let the other live, the Lord went on to Dwarka to visit relatives. Returning to Naimisharanya, Balaram declared to all the saints and sages holding sacrifices there, that he would join their sacrifice. What's more, he told his friends, "My long career of warfare has at last come to an end." Lord Balaram blessed everyone assembled in that place with spiritual perception that transcended time and space. They saw Lord Balaram pervading everything, and then they saw Lord Balaram holding the universe within. According to the Vedic rites, Lord Balaram took part in rituals a common man would use to cleanse his heart. Encircled by his family and closest friends that day, he looked as splendid as the moon surrounded by its rays. Lord Balaram's deluding powers make the common man think he is common too, and this exactly suits his plan. Yet one who simply hears of Balaram's divine pursuits becomes adored by Krishna, whose response is absolute. Gopal Prabhu, we are ready. So this relationship between Krishna and Balaram is so subtle and interesting, because Balaram takes care of everyone that Krishna doesn't want to deal with. Everyone and everything. So he's his first expansion, and Krishna basically delegates all the nasty stuff to Balaram. And he stays and does all the fun stuff.
Well, there's a very important purport in here, and actually most of it is Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, who's quoting his description on this part of the Bhagavatam. So I want to get that on the screen. I'll read it here, and if you want, you can read along to it. And if there's any time left over, there's a few things I can say. But this is just evidence that relationships with Krishna are eternal and genuine, and not so how the material relationships are so often very disappointing and are always transient. So it's Canto 10, chapter 78, verse 16, and this is the purport that's really most important. It speaks about Krishna going back to Dwarka. He did keep his promise and he went back to Dwarka. And it's in the Padma Purana. It's also described why it's not in the Bhagavatam. So to the best of my knowledge, most devotees don't know this. So, 16. Chapter 78, text 16. I'm not very good at Sanskrit, so I'm going to skip that. This is killing of Dhanvantarka and Mahamarsha. It's described, this is Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti gives the following elaborate commentary on this section of Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay. Thus Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the master of all mystic power and Lord of the universe, is ever victorious. Only those of beastly vision think he sometimes suffers defeat. That was a translation, the purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti gives the following elaborate commentary on this section of Srimad Bhagavatam. Concerning the killing of Dhanvantarka, the Uta Kanda of the Padma Purana contains further details in the following prose passage. Then hearing that Sishupal had been killed, Dantavarkra went to Mathura to fight against Krishna. When Krishna moreover heard of this, he mounted his chariot and went to Mathura. Between the two of them, Dhanvantarka and Lord Vasudev, there then began a battle at the gate of Mathura that lasted all day and night. Finally, Krishna struck Dhanvantarka with his club, at which point Dantavarkra fell lifeless to the ground, all of his limbs smashed like a mountain shattered by a lightning bolt. Dantavarkra achieved the liberation of gaining a form equal to the Lord's, and thus he also achieved the Lord's eternal supreme abode, attainable by perfect yogis, which bestows the happiness of everlasting spiritual bliss. Yeah, he actually gained his eternal spiritual form, it says. So it was the Jai and Vijay, apparently because of being cursed by Shanaka and his brothers, but actually to facilitate the Supreme Lord's pastimes, descended to this material world, and in three consecutive lifetimes were killed by the Lord himself. Then at the completion of these three lifetimes, they attained liberation. In this passage of the Padma Purana, the words Krishna tu chakravarta when Krishna heard of this, indicate that the Lord heard from Narada, who travels as swiftly as the mind, that Dhanvantara had gone to Mathura. Therefore, immediately after killing Salava, without first entering Dwarka, the Lord reached the vicinity of Mathura in a single moment on his chariot, which also moves as swiftly as the mind, and there saw Dhanvantara. Thus it is that even today, by the gate of Mathura, facing the direction of Dwarka, there is a village known in the vernacular as Daita, a name derived from the Sanskrit Dhanvantara Hai, killer of Dhanvantara. This village was founded by Krishna's great-grandson, Viraja. And after killing Vridharatha, Krishna crossed the Yamuna and went to the cowherd village of Nanda, where he honored and consoled his aggrieved parents. They drenched him with tears and embraced him, and then the Lord offered obeisances to the elder cowherd men and gratified all the residents with abundant gifts of clothing, ornaments, and so on. This is a Padma Purana. Lord Keshava sported continuously with the cowherd women on the Kalindi's charming bank, which was filled with pious trees. Thus the Supreme Lord, assuming the appearance of a cowherd resident there for 2 months, enjoying the pleasure of intimate pastimes and various moods of loving reciprocation. Then by Lord Vasudeva's grace, Nanda and all the other residents of that place, together with their children and wives, assumed their eternal spiritual forms, boarded a celestial airplane, and ascended to the supreme Vaikuntha planet, Goloka Vrindavan. Lord Krishna, however, after bestowing on Nanda Gopa and all the other inhabitants of Raja his own transcendental abode, which is free from all disease, traveled through the sky and returned to Dwarka as demigods chanted his praises. Srila Rupa Goswami comments as follows on this passage. Since Drona and other demigods had previously descended to earth to merge as partial expansions into the king of Raja and other devotees of Vrindavan, at this time it was these demigod expansions whom Lord Krishna sent off to Vaikuntha. Lord Hari is perpetually enjoying pastimes in Vrindavan with his intimate devotees, the residents of Gokula, who are dearer to him than even his most dear other devotees. In the passage of Padma Purana, the word putra in the phrase Nanda Gopa and others together with their children and wives refers to such sons as Krishna, Sridham, and Subala, while the word Dara refers to such wives as Sri Yasoda and Kirtida, the mother of Radharani. The phrase all the people refers to everyone living in the district of Raja. Thus they all went to the topmost Vaikuntha planet, Goloka. The phrase indicates that Goloka engages in pastimes appropriate to demigods, not those situated to humans, as in Gokula. Just as during Lord Ramachandra's incarnation, the residents of Ayodhya were transported to Vaikuntha in their selfsame bodies, so in this incarnation of Krishna, the residents of Raja attained to Goloka in theirs. Lord Krishna's journey from Dwarka to Vraja is confirmed by the following passage. This is Srimad Bhagavatam 111.9. I looked up this passage at one time. It's kind of elusive, I guess. But, O Lord, O lotus-eyed Lord, whenever you go away to Mathura, Vrindavan, or Hastinapura to meet your friends and relatives, every moment of your absence seems like millions of years. So I guess it indicates he went back to Vrindavan. Lord Krishna had been harboring a desire to go see his friends and relatives in Vraja ever since Lord Baladev had gone there, but his mother, father, and other elders in Dwarka had refused to give him permission. Now, however, after killing of Salva, when Krishna heard from Narada that Dhanvantara had gone to Mathura, no one could object to the Lord's going there immediately without first entering Dwarka, and after killing Dhanvantara, he would have the opportunity to meet with his friends and relatives living in Vraja. Thinking like this and also remembering Uddhava's allusion to the gopis, he went to Vraja, dispelling the feelings of separation of the inhabitants. For 2 months, Lord Krishna enjoyed in Vrindavan just as before, previous to his leaving there to kill Kamsa and Mathura. Then at the end of 2 months, he withdrew his Vraja pastimes from mundane eyes by taking the demigod portions of his parents and other relatives and friends to Vaikuntha. This is one complete plenary manifestation. He went to Goloka. Thus, in one complete plenary manifestation, he went to Goloka in the spiritual world. In another, he remained perpetually enjoying in Vraja while invisible to material eyes. And in yet another, he mounted his chariot and returned alone to Dwarka. The people of Surusena province thought that after killing Dhanvantara, Krishna had paid a visit to his parents and other dear ones and now was returning to Dwarka. The people of Raja, on the other hand, could not understand where he had suddenly disappeared to, and so they were totally astonished. I don't really quite understand what's said there. Furthermore, Sukadev considered that Parikshit Maharaj might think, how is it that the same Krishna who caused the cowherds to attain Vaikuntha in their self-same bodies also caused the residents of Dwarka to attain such an inauspicious condition in the course of his Mahusala Leela? Yeah, the Mahusala Leela is some boys were in front of some sages at an assembly of sages, and they were kind of trying to tease the sages a little bit, and they dressed Samba as a woman. And Samba asked the sages, will I give birth to a boy or a girl? And the sages, weren't fooled, and they actually took offense and said, you will give birth to a lump of iron that will destroy your entire family. So they lifted Samba's skirt, and there was a big lump of iron there. They took to Madhushai Yudhishthir? Ugrasen. And Ugrasen ground it into very small, fine particles and threw it in the ocean. All that was left was a little chunk, which was later carved into an arrowhead and used to kill, swallowed by a fish or something like that. And it ended up used to kill. That was actually used to kill Krishna, right? Krishna appeared to leave, and the shavings washed up on the shore, and they grew into these canes that were steel, and the relatives of Krishna, after Krishna left the planet, were so powerful that the earth was overburdened. There was no way anybody could defeat them, and so it was Krishna's arrangement that they got intoxicated, which Kshatriyas sometimes do. And just got in an argument and beat each other all to death. And since thus the king might consider the arrangement unfair because of his own affinity for the Yadus. That is why Sukadev Goswami did not allow him to hear this pastime, which, as mentioned above, is related in the Uttara Kanda of the Srimad Padma Purana. In Sri Vaishnava Toshani, Sanatha Goswami's commentary on the 10th canto, we find the following sequential list of pastimes. First was the journey on the occasion of the solar eclipse, then the Raja Surya assembly, then the gambling match and attempted disrobing of Draupadi, then the Pandavas' exile to the forest, then the killing of Shalva and Danvantara, then Krishna's visit to Vrindavan, and finally the winding up of the Vrindavan pastimes. So I just thought, while we're going over the 10th canto, everyone should hear that. Excuse me? Yes, I believe so, yes. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the warfare and the etiquette of warfare that took place back then, even in the slaying of Shalva, who were demons, how is described. If they saw their opponent doing very heroic deeds, they would stop and commend him and say, very well done. And also they were Kshatriyas, and the Battle of Kurukshetra was fought way away from regular population, so to minimize the killing of innocent people. And Kshatriyas that's their, I don't know if there's any true Kshatriyas nowadays, but that was their nature. They would fight till they win or they would die. And this battle was ordained by Krishna. But the battle would begin at sunrise and end at sunset. And at sunset, the warriors would go to each other's camps and associate as friends and share dinner together. So this is completely different from any kind of warfare we have today, which is just karmic warfare. It's not religious warfare. It's just karmic reaction warfare. At least that's the way I understand it. Kalikanta made the comment that professors look at the amount of Krishna's relatives and wonder where did they put all the bathrooms. One of the things I was always wondered about is what do they do for cooking arrangements on the battlefield of the crew, etc. You know, they must have had a whole army to cook. You know, giant walks or what? Bringing cartloads full of vegetables. I think there was millions of people on the battle of the crew, etc. So who did all? How'd they cook all the food for all those people? That's what I always wondered. So. Yeah, it mentions a little bit about Maharathis too, which I wanted to talk about. A Maharathi can fight with 1,000 men single-handedly, and I have some martial arts. It was nothing I was ever able to master, but I did take it off and on during my life and enjoyed very much. And one time I saw this 7th-level black belt do a demonstration of a form or kata, and it was probably in a room just about twice as big as this one, and there was at least 20 or 30 of us lined up in rows. Anyways, he was like doing a ballerina pirouette or something. He like was dancing around, and within a matter of seconds he had passed everybody in that entire room. So imagine if you like had a sword or a hatchet or something like that, you know, or even a club, the damage that could be done. It was just like, you know, he just danced. It was like he took a pirouette. He just, in a matter of seconds, he had passed every single person in that entire room. It's a 7th-level black belt kata that I saw one time. So that might give some kind of indication. I don't know if that can be done with 1,000 men, but Parashuram could move so fast that he could decapitate an entire phalanx of an army without anybody even seeing him. Just all the heads would just all of a sudden drop. And when he was getting tired, he would move at the speed of the wind. So this is something that was discussed. This is something that's in the Bhagavatam about Parashuram that wasn't discussed when we went over that part of the Bhagavatam. So the killing of Roma Sharna, there's also different types of martial arts that kind of mythological maybe that you can kill somebody without touching them. It's considered kind of unethical in the Kung circles. But even the Brahmins cursed Maharaj Vena to die. So I'm not saying that's like, you know, the Supreme Personality killing someone with a blade of kusha grass, but you know, because he doesn't need to master any mystic power to do that. I just thought that was something that could maybe be added. And that's really about all I have to say. So I don't know if there's any questions or comments. It's a purport by Vishvanath Chakravarti Thakur, and also by Rupa Goswami, I think, also. Lord Krishna returned to Vrindavan for 2 months and sported with all the residents of Vrindavan just like he did previously to going to kill Kamsa. And then at the end of those 2 months, he took all the residents of Raja back to Goloka Vrindavan in one expansion. In another expansion, he stayed in Vrindavan unmanifest to material eyes because he never takes a step out of Vrindavan. And in the third expansion, he went back to Dwarka. And the killing of Donfantarka actually facilitated this because he was able to get close enough to Vrindavan where he could go and visit without the people of Dwarka, you know, objecting, because he had wanted to go for quite some time, but the people of Dwarka wouldn't give him permission. And since he was following the rules of Dharma, he was abiding by the wishes of his superiors. So. Right. Well, that was Dwarka. That wasn't in Vrindavan. The solar eclipse, when they reunited with the solar eclipse, they were in Dwarka. Well, I've heard actually different stories about, hinting that different stories. I'm not sure where they come from, that Krishna actually did visit Vrindavan. This isn't the only incident, possibly, but. Apparently, it's not really well known. It's always described that Krishna never returned to Vrindavan, and it's not in the Bhagavatam for the reason mentioned here. So, all right. Well, I got to get back to work. Thank you very much. Yeah.